From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The Yankees are stale, the Dodgers are flat, but the Milwaukee Brewers are coming on in leaps and bounds, if not hops. Ahead on Only a Game, playoff fever hits Paris on the Menominee. Also, Tim Kirkchin waxes prosaic on those Yankees, who may or may not still be the Yankees. A college football preview and American basketball stars visit Seeds of Peace Camp. Also ahead, working lobstermen put the pedal to the metal with souped-up lobster boats.
When you spend 5 or 6 days a week with your head stuck in a trap, it's nice to get together with other people who are in the same boat, really, and have a good time.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Oh, it's a long, long way from May to September. The Cleveland Indians, perhaps you remember. The Tigers of Detroit, New York's fabled Yankees. Their fans, once confident, have taken out hankies. However, it's the nature of the sport that the disappointment engulfing the fans of one city is directly proportionate to the increase in enthusiasm somewhere else. It's Littlefield's first law of baseball dynamics. And now, as I welcome ESPN's Tim Kirkchin back to the program, we'll see if somebody who knows something about the game agrees with that theory. Hi, Tim.
How are you, Bill?
Pretty good, thank you. Let's get it out of the way right up top. Are the Yankees still the Yankees?
The Yankees are no longer the Yankees, at least not for this year, Bill. As you know, I'm always the last guy to give up on the Yankees. But this year is different. They've lost Jorge Posada. They've lost Chin-Ming Wong. Some of their young kids, including Phil Hughes and Ian Kennedy, haven't been what they thought they would be. It's actually quite remarkable that they're still in the pennant race, that they're still not eliminated yet. But with all due respect, when you have to start Sidney Ponson, who's been with many teams, in an almost a make-or-break game against the Boston Red Sox at Yankee Stadium, that's just not good enough when you're the Yankees.
Tim, you are my favorite source of baseball history. So, has any player acquired mid-season ever helped his new team as much as CC Sabathia has helped the Milwaukee Brewers?
Only one in baseball history, and that was Rick Sutcliffe in 1984. Now, keep in mind, he joined the Cubs in May of that year from Cleveland after a relatively slow start in Cleveland. Then he went 16-1 for the Cubs, won the Cy Young by a mile that year over Dwight Gooden, finished fourth in the MVP voting, and ended up taking the Cubs into the playoffs. CC Sabathia doesn't have enough time to do all that. However, he still has a chance to go 13-14-0 and take the Brewers to the playoffs, and I fully expect the latter to happen. And he has rejuvenated baseball in Milwaukee. Bill, they used to get 14,000 on a Monday night in Milwaukee if they were lucky. He pitched on a Monday night a couple of weeks ago. 41,000 people came.
You mentioned the Chicago Cubs. Are they going to be okay as the weather cools?
Bill, they're not just going to be okay. They are going to win the World Series this year. It came to me in the night. I figured it out finally. Baseball is the most symmetrical sport in the world. Baseball gods are always looking out. They always take care of us, and they always provide us, almost always, with the best story. And there cannot be a better story, period, than the Cubs winning the World Series on the 100-year anniversary of the last time they won. And it really helps that the baseball gods will look at this and say, well, the Cubs have the best players in the National League, so they're going to win that pennant, and I think they're going to win the World Series this year.
The Angels of Anaheim, a city in Southern California more or less adjacent to Los Angeles, are coasting. But is coasting a good thing to be doing in late August? Can it hurt the Angels to be so far ahead in their division?
You know, we've heard that before. The good thing is it means by coasting, they can get their pitching straight. They can rest a guy who may need a rest just as long as he's ready on October 1st. I think it's a good thing they're this far ahead. I think they can set their roster, set their pitching, get completely healthy, and I think they will be the team to beat in the American League when the playoffs begin.
For the Dodgers of Los Angeles, a city in Southern California more or less adjacent to Anaheim, the wild card does not seem likely. L.A. probably will not make the postseason unless they overtake the Arizona Diamondbacks. Even with Manny Ramirez, are they likely to do so?
I don't think they're going to overtake the Diamondbacks. I picked the Dodgers at the beginning of the season, but even with Manny Ramirez, their offense has just been hideous. During a recent 7-game stretch, they scored 12 runs, and that's with Manny in the lineup. And teams are now have already figured it out. Don't pitch to him. Let somebody else beat us, and nobody else is beating them.
Tim, Tampa Bay no longer has the best record in baseball. However, the Rays are still the only first-place team to have finished all but one of their previous seasons in last place. Do you like them to finish strong?
Bill, they have completely won me over in every way, and they are winning still without three of their best players. So there is something really special going on in Tampa Bay, and it's real simple. They are pitching so much better than they ever have in the history of the franchise. Their defense is so much better than it was last year. It's not even close. And those are the two biggest reasons why. Now if they can get some people to show up and watch their games on a Wednesday night, Thursday night in Tampa Bay, then they've really got it covered.
Sometimes these conversations with you generate emails from angry people who want to know why we haven't talked about their favorite teams. So, on their behalf, which other team or teams should we be discussing now, Tim?
I think we need to figure out who's going to win the National League East, whether it's the Phillies or the Mets, because even though I've just told you the Cubs are going to the World Series and they're going to win it, they might have to get through one of those East teams, whichever team makes it. The problem is I go back and forth on those teams literally every day. Who's good? Who isn't good? How flawed are they? But they're fascinating to watch, and the Mets are the most fascinating team in that respect because they spend so much money to get better. I picked them to go to the World Series at the beginning of the year, and then, of course, I completely counted them out when they were terrible, and now I've got them back in the playoffs. So I don't know what's going on with the Mets, but that you can't take your eyes off them because something crazy might happen if you're not watching.
Tim Kirkjian is known to television viewers as ESPN's baseball expert, discriminating fans who prefer radio know him as only a games diamond expert. Thanks very much, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
Last year, at this time, the Milwaukee Brewers trailed the Chicago Cubs by just 2.5 games in the National League Central, but the Brewers faded and missed the postseason. Though the Brewers currently trail the Cubs, they're ahead of St. Louis in the wild card standings, and there's optimism that the Brew Crew will make its first playoff appearance in 26 years. Mitch Tyke of Milwaukee Public Radio reports.
The last time the Milwaukee Brewers made the playoffs, their backup catcher was a 27-year-old Californian named Ned Yost. Yost made one appearance in the 82 World Series, and his playing fortunes and the Brewers went downhill after that. Yost came back to Milwaukee in 2003 to manage the team. Watching batting practice before a recent game at Miller Park, Yost looked back on his first couple of years leading a mediocre team.
I mean, back then, we'd win a baseball game and people would congratulate you for 4 or 5 days. You know, it was like we were playing football. You know, it's like, hey, congratulations on that win 3 days ago. Thanks.
But the Brewers stuck with Yost, and the team started to shed its image as perennial bottom dwellers. They surprised many in the NL last year when they jumped out to a substantial lead in the Central Division and held it for much of the year before injuries and inexperience led to a late-season swoon. Yost believes this year's team is in much better shape, physically and mentally, heading into September.
Now being through it like they went through it last year, they understand what it's like. They understand the ups and downs of it. They understand that if something happens, it's not the end of the world. You know, that we come back tomorrow and we just get right back after it again.
While last year's thwarted pennant race is important to the holdovers from the 2007 club, the Brewers' successes this year have just as much to do with the veterans they've added to the mix. If the 08 Brewers were still under anyone's radar at the beginning of the season, general manager Doug Melvin changed that when he traded for C.C. Sabathia, the reigning AL Cy Young Award winner, just before the All-Star break. But Melvin points to a handful of players he signed in the offseason, whom he says put them in a position where Sabathia would even make a difference.
We were a young club last year, and this year we pursued a number of veterans that we felt would come in and help our ball club, and Jason Kendall and Mike Cameron, for example, are two of them, and Eric Gagne and David Riske and Solomon Torres, and they've all fit in and with our younger players and that. So it's taken a little bit of the pressure off of younger players when you're in a pennant race.
Of the players Melvin mentioned, the Kendall acquisition may have been the most important. He's acquitted himself decently at the plate, but it's his role as the everyday catcher that has coaches and teammates most impressed. Kendall's already set the team record for most starts at catcher in a season. He's handling a staff that now includes three frontline starters, Sabathia, longtime Brewer Ben Sheets, and Jeff Suppan, who was last year's big signing. Sabathia has been nothing short of amazing with Milwaukee, already leading the NL in complete games even though he only arrived in July. The notoriously fragile Sheets is already at a career high in wins, and Suppan has been solid as the number three starter. He's been in pennant races in Boston and St. Louis, and Suppan says the chemistry in Milwaukee is right.
And I think the only way you can learn is by being a part of it and being a part of a playoff run. It's a different feeling. I've been on teams that have won 100 and lost 100, so definitely that was a big transition for us last year, being a part of it and missing by, couple games.
The savviest part of Doug Melvin's roster moves may have been his contingency plans. He paid $10 million to bring in Eric Gagne as the team's closer for the year. Gagne bombed in the role, but another acquisition, Solomon Torres, took over and has thrived. Outfielder Mike Cameron was suspended for the first 25 games of the year for testing positive for a banned stimulant, and so another unheralded pickup stepped in. Gabe Kapler spent the 2007 season managing in the Red Sox farm system. But he thought he could still play in the majors, and it seems he was right. He's batting 300 for the Brewers, and while he's now the team's fourth outfielder, he's among the league pinch-hitting leaders. Kapler was on the Red Sox team that won the 2004 World Series, and he sees some commonalities between the scenes at Fenway Park and Miller Park.
It's actually more similar than I ever thought it would be. Considering the passion these fans have for baseball and the fact that they're coming out in groves to watch us play, and also the intensity that my teammates have for getting to the postseason and beyond.
But the issue of free agents is on the minds of many among the droves of fans outside the stadium, where the parking lot is so full of tailgaters you can smell the brats as you drive by on I-94. Both Sabathia and Sheets could be gone after October, so the fans are hopeful this is the Brewers' year. Corey Morgan is from Milwaukee, and so far, he has no complaints.
Well, they got a new attitude this year. They're playing well. They might make the playoffs.
What do you think the attitude has been in years past?
The attitude has been to try to have a winning team, and this year they actually are having a winning team.
Even so, the leaves will soon change in Wisconsin, and so Morgan was tailgating in his full Packers attire. But considering the turmoil at Lambeau Field this summer, Morgan says he's in the unusual position of being more optimistic about the Brewers than the Packers.
That organization has to deal with what they've chose, and the Brewers are totally different, a different administration, and they've done the right moves. They put a winning team on the field, so now it just comes down to whether or not they actually get it done.
And in the end, if the Brewers don't win the World Series, that might be the team's most remarkable accomplishment, making a state full of sports fans forget about Brett Favre for a while. For Only a Game, I'm Mitch Teich in Milwaukee.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. McCain wins! McCain wins! That's doubtless what the spectators at the New Jersey Pest Management Association's annual clinic and trade show were shouting when the giant Madagascar hissing cockroach named McCain scuttled across the finish line ahead of another roach named Obama, who was reportedly reluctant to scuttle, let alone hiss. Republicans should be cautious about celebrating too early, though. The Pest Management Association's director, Leonard Duglin, has been presiding over cockroach races for some time, and he recalls that in the 2000 event, the roach named Gore beat the one named Bush by an antenna. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game. Kids from Palestine and Israel work things out on and off the court with some help from some NBA stars. But first, the college football season began on Thursday. Joining me now to marvel at how quickly the games have crept up on us is Yahoo Sports columnist Dan Wetzel. Dan, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great college football teams would seem to be rather evenly distributed this year around the country, so it's a little hard to know where to begin. But why not at the top with the Southeastern Conference, which includes six teams in the top 25 of the preseason rankings? Talk to me about some of them.
Well, no question. Once again, I know you follow this closely.
Very closely.
You probably follow this SEC as closely as the other SEC. No question they got the best teams. They have it every year in, year out. And the question for Georgia, which is the current number one, Florida, which turns the Heisman Trophy winner, Auburn, which has a tremendous defense, and down the line, Tennessee, LSU, the defending national champions, all top 15, 20 teams, is can they survive the intense competition in their own league? You're going to have to beat four or five ranked teams, if not up to seven ranked teams. So in a lot of ways, the hardest thing about being an SEC team is the SEC. It tends to attract the best players, but it also makes it very difficult to win a national championship, although the last 2 years that has happened.
LSU was the national champion last year, and some have predicted that the result will be the same this year. But LSU's top quarterback this year might be a Harvard man, Andrew Hatch. How do you like that storyline?
Not only might be, but it's going to be. They had a transfer from Harvard. They had a transfer out. They had some different discipline problems. So we have no problem with the brains working in Baton Rouge. We'll see whether that's going to be enough. I think LSU probably is going to have a hard time overcoming a number of slots to fill, but they're going to have a tremendous defense and a great home field. Don't think it's going to be enough for them to win the national championship, but they will not be far behind.
Ohio State will play at USC 2 weeks from today. Has something gotten into the water in Columbus that would cause the Buckeyes to schedule a game against a worthy competitor so early in the season?
Well, they opened the day with Youngstown State, which is usually their best bet going that way. This will be obviously an incredibly tough game. USC probably has the most talent of any team in the country. They recruiting-wise, they clean up every single year. This is going to be a huge game because they almost cannot afford one loss because the pollsters and the people that will choose the championship game, I think, will hold a bias against them from the last two drubbings in the title game. It's been very boring championship games, so they have to go and win in Los Angeles. Daunting, daunting task.
I'm told by a little leather-helmeted leprechaun who stops by the Only a Game office every once in a while that Notre Dame might not stink this year. Can that be true? And if so, will it be a good thing for college football?
Yeah, if they get any worse, they will have to raid Harvard for all their players. So it was a horrible year for Notre Dame last season. Notre Dame should be better. Charlie Weiss has recruited very well. He has a lot of good young players in that program. I don't think they're going to contend for the national championship. I don't think they're going to win 10 games, but they should get 6, 7, 8 games. And this is a lot of pressure on Charlie Weiss. He signed a huge contract at Notre Dame in the middle of his very first season. I think college football is more fun when Notre Dame is winning. I think whether you like them or hate them, they're fun to have around. And so as a fan of the sport at whole, I'd like to see him do a little bit better, although I think a lot of people enjoyed whipping the Irish last year.
To which of today's games will you be paying close attention?
Well, the best game today is Alabama and Clemson tonight. They're playing in Atlanta. Both teams are ranked. I think it's the only game with two ranked teams. Nick Saban is in his second year at Alabama. Everyone wants to see what he can do. The other one that interests me is actually Appalachian State playing at LSU. 1 year later, you know, can they shock the world again? LSU, like you said, has got a new quarterback. They got a lot of question marks. Obviously, overwhelming favorites. But Appalachian State is a real powerhouse program at the 1AA level, and they return many of the same players to beat Michigan. Should be a really interesting game. That's going to be on national television. That's how excited people are about Appalachian State.
Okay, we love, we hate to do this to our analysts, but here goes. Which team wins the national championship on January 8th in Miami?
I think it's going to be USC will beat Florida for the national championship. I think those two teams have the best talent. I think USC has got a very good path to the title. I think they will beat Ohio State in L.A. and run the table and be undefeated. And I think Florida will end up with maybe a loss, but they will end up as the SEC champions and will get that nod for playing the toughest round. Tim Tebow returns, the Heisman Trophy winner. Great talent. I just think USC beats them down in Florida. That's my pick. Call me every week, and we'll redo the pick.
We'll make adjustments as necessary. Dan Wetzel wrote a stunning 24 columns from Beijing during the Summer Games, but he covers a multitude of subjects for Yahoo Sports. Dan, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Hey, thanks for having me. Anytime.
Each summer, the Seeds of Peace Camp in Otisfield, Maine, brings together over 300 Afghan, American, Egyptian, Indian, Israeli, Jordanian, Pakistani, and Palestinian participants with an interest in peaceful conflict resolution. Perhaps not surprisingly, sports are woven throughout the camp curriculum. Last month, Only a Game's Ken Shulman attended the camp's NBA Day, and he has our report.
The painted log cabins, the playing fields, the unforgettable blue of a New England lake. If it weren't for the security guards at the gate, you'd think this was just another teenage retreat.
This guy is so fast that he could probably steal the kosher halal bacon.
165 kids in green camp t-shirts, jamming and dancing in two wooden grandstands. Girls on the left, boys on the right. If it weren't for the accents, the occasional headscarf, and some exceptionally tall visitors high-fiving their way down the aisle, you'd think this was just another sports camp in Maine.
He was selected number one overall in the 2008 Seeds of Peace and NBA draft, making his first Seeds of Peace appearance, soon to be with the Chicago Bulls, Memphis, Eric Rowe.
Seeds of Peace is a camp where teenagers born as enemies learn to work with the other side. Founded in 1993, the camp has hosted kids from the Middle East, South Asia, Cyprus, and the Balkans. Seeds alumni now represent their countries in high-level peace negotiations. Today is NBA Day at Seeds of Peace, an annual highlight when pro hoop stars come to teach kids from Israel and Palestine how to run a fast break or nail down a three-point shot. The skills may not seem vital steps on the road to peace, but for these kids, it's a good start. Mirnan is a 17-year-old Palestinian girl from East Jerusalem.
Everyone knows basketball, and if they don't know that, know it, they just grab the ball and shoot it, and everyone can have fun together. It's like, it's the rope that makes everyone like play together and smile and laugh and shoot hoops and all these stuff. So it gathers people together.
Most of the players here today are NBA rookies. Center Brook Lopez and his twin brother Robin starred last season at Stanford. This morning they shepherd kids who barely come up to their waists into a ragtag layup line. For Brook, kids are kids no matter where they're from.
I'm surprised, you know, they say there's so much conflict out there. In the Middle East, obviously, there is. But you come out here and you see these guys just acting like regular teenagers, you know, it's wonderful.
Will Smith is assistant director at Seeds of Peace and played college ball in Maine at Bowdoin. Sport, he says, is a big part of the process here. So are the daily dialogue sessions, which are tougher than the toughest basketball workout. Smith says the athlete's presence helps validate the kids' hard work.
They know that it's an important thing to be an NBA player. And they know that there are other things that these guys could be doing. Plus, they're 15, 16, 17-year-old. It's bragging rights. Even if they don't know who this guy is today, they'll be able to hold up that picture when they go home and say, I got a picture with Derrick Rose. And they say, who's Derrick Rose? I don't know, but he's some famous NBA guy. It's bragging rights.
At lunch, Seeds of Peace campers and staff give their visitors a rowdy welcome. Boston Celtic forward Brian Scalabrine, L.A. Laker Jordan Farmer, and former Chicago Bulls standout B.J. Armstrong respond in kind, trading cheers and drumming on wooden lunch tables. Outside, just finished with a cell phone interview, future Chicago Bull Derrick Rose watches a little wistfully.
Yeah, I love it. I wish I was a camper here, but because I never went to camp when I was younger. I missed out. Just coming here just makes me feel kind of sad that I've never been invited to nothing like this or even tried to get in. And I was always on the court.
My name is Roy. I'm 16 years old and I live in Israel.
Lunch is over. Now it's the kids' turn to teach. The players drape over knee-high picnic tables as Rui describes how camp has changed how he sees the other side. His friends back home in Israel ask him what the Palestinians are like and if they really want to hurt Israelis.
You heard this question and you're like, what? No way. No way. That I can't believe that any of these kids will do such thing. So basically, I do believe that we are spreading the idea of peace in the place that we are coming from. And I really hope and believe that it is helping to make our life a little bit better.
But not all the stories here have such happy endings, or are easy to tell. Some of the players squirm as a Palestinian girl talks about the hardships in her homeland. A girlfriend from a refugee camp in Jenin holds her hand.
People aren't going to schools. We're not getting educated. We're not living our teen life. Yesterday when we had the dialogue, our American friends, they were like talking about their lives, how they go party, like they do all these stuff that we are prevented from doing. We can't go party, we can't go out together at night because we are afraid that something will happen to us. We're not living ordinary lives.
And sometimes sports does not reach a more intellectual level. It reaches a gut level where sometimes a lot of hate is stored and it brings it out.
Sue Wick knows sport can teach teamwork and self-reliance. The former WNBA standout and current college coach learned many valuable lessons on the court. But during her 4 years of pro ball in Israel, she also saw games go ugly.
We were playing a team, and their soccer team had a Palestinian player. The boys that were soccer fans came to our game, and they were chanting this awful, hateful chant against the Palestinian male player that wasn't even present. They just thought this was an appropriate chant to play at our game.
For many of the NBA players, the stories of life in Israel and Palestine remind them of their own inner-city youth. One or two ask questions. Most keep quiet and lower their gaze, afraid perhaps of staring at kids only a few years younger than they, who seem so much older right now.
There's no doubt to me that while the kids are impacted, I think my players I have found over the last 6 or 7 years have been equally impacted.
Pro sports agent Arne Tellem is the man most responsible for NBA Day. As a boy, he attended another camp on this same site. Each summer, he brings 7 or 8 rookies and a few veterans up for the day. Tellem says it's a welcome break for his players and an opportunity for them to learn about the world.
I get calls in the middle of the day from players that have watched CNN and saw a news report about the Middle East and saying they watched something or reading about something in the newspaper. But the players know a lot more about the Middle East leaving this camp than they did coming in.
While the NBA players reap dividends from their main visit, they also sow seeds of goodwill and of basketball. Rowan Aidi is a 17-year-old Palestinian from Ramallah, back for a second summer at Seeds of Peace.
They came to give us something. They came to teach us something, and I love that. I didn't play basketball every time, and I don't like basketball, but after today I start to like this game, and I'm going to play it.
A basketball court, a blare of hip-hop, and a bunch of athletes and kids swapping skills and stories. If it weren't for the legacy of loss, of hatred, and of reconciliation, you'd think this was just another summer place. For Only a Game, I'm Ken Schulman at Seeds of Peace in Otis Field, Maine.
You're listening to Only a Game. During last week's program, the Only a Game poolside players presented some speculation on what sort of movie roles might await Michael Phelps, the most prolific winner of gold medals the games have ever seen. Ron Johnson, who downloads the show in Frankfurt, Germany, emailed to say, "I thought the Michael Phelps bit was great. Keep up all the laughing." Regarding that skit, Adam Fieldsteel, who hears the program on WSHU in Connecticut, Ron Zalewski, who listens to WUOM in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Bob Hart, a WEVO listener in New Hampshire, were among the many who wrote to point out that when Yoda suggested that Michael Phelps was several parsecs faster than his competitors, he mistook a measure of distance for a measure of time. We asked Yoda if he had, in fact, made an error.
No.
Or no, not exactly. In fact, our Yoda was quoting Han Solo from the first Star Wars film, and whether Mr. Solo made a mistake depends on how one regards the relationship between time and space, which, I'm told, is complicated.
No.
Yeah, well, it's the best I can do. Last week, I also spoke with Nicholas Davidoff about his profile of John McEnroe in the Sunday New York Times Magazine. Mr. Davidoff found Mr. McEnroe compelling. Phyllis Forbes, who hears only a game on WCPN in Cleveland, did not. "John McEnroe compelling?" she wrote. "Give me a break. He is as compelling as a four-year-old in full tantrum. And he is almost 50. Grow up, John. That behavior was not attractive in the prime of your tennis career, and it is not attractive now." Retta Chin, who hears the program on WAMU in Washington, D.C., emailed to say, "Thanks for your coverage of the Olympic Games in Beijing. I was wondering if you're going to continue coverage with the Paralympic Games." Wonder no more, Ms. Chin. Anderson Wise, the Paralympic powerlifter we profiled several months ago, departs for Beijing shortly, and I'll be talking with him for next week's show. Should you have suggestions, corrections, or congratulations, you can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org. Our address is Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
2 bits, 4 bits, 6 bits a dollar. How you gonna make a peppy cheerleader holler? On the diamond, in the field, or up and down the court? Say to school she cannot go, her skirt's too short. A new dress code in Monroe, Ohio schools prohibits all short skirts, including the ones cheerleaders are accustomed to wearing in class on game days. Said the mother of one cheerleader, "We've spent more than $400 on the uniform." She added, "The cheerleaders feel like they've been stripped of everything they've earned." She really said that. Honest. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, you can get there from here, assuming your lobster boat is fast enough. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for Look the Week's News. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
On Thursday, 188th-ranked Julie Kwan provided one of the greatest upsets in the history of tennis by upending number one seed Anna Ivanovic in the second round of the U.S. Open. You think number 188 will keep going?
I don't think so. I think she's had her day in the sun, alas. Ivanovic has been injured. She withdrew from the Olympics. She's got a bad thumb, but this is still an earthquake for the U.S. Open. I mean, there are doors opening all over the place in the drawer now.
On the men's side, Rafael Nadal keeps rolling on. I guess the effort necessary to win the Olympic gold medal has not much tired him out.
Well, he's 22 years old. He's got a lot of pep left in his legs, I'm sure. Yeah, he beat up an American qualifier named Ryland DeHart, 6-1, 6-2, 6-4. I have a feeling that the men's draw in the U.S. Open is just going to be an extended victory lap for this guy.
Members of the PGA this week criticized the LPGA's new English-only rule. Do you think any of the objections will do anything to change that policy in the LPGA?
Boy, I hope so, because this is really a stupid, xenophobic piece of trash, this rule. It's totally aimed at the fact that suddenly there's an influx of Asian players onto the LPGA Tour, notably players from South Korea. And how would the United States of America and its sports fans feel if suddenly this rule started getting enforced in track meets in Europe and American sprinters couldn't run because they didn't speak Spanish, or they didn't speak French, or they didn't speak Italian? I mean, it's bad enough we do a disgraceful job of teaching foreign languages in this country. Now we're going to make people come over here and pass an English exam so they can get along with the sponsors and the corporate suits on Pro-Am Day. I guarantee you most of the corporate suits couldn't pass an English exam.
Well, of course, my feeling is that it's the Koreans' fault, because if they didn't win so many tournaments, if they weren't such good golfers, this never would have come up.
That's true. Your attitude towards meritocracy is interesting, but somewhat baffling.
College football has begun.
Yay, I watched some.
Do all of your Labor Day weekend plans revolve around the games, the glorious games?
No, I can't really say so. We're in the silly season. A couple of really good teams are playing very early. Southern Cal is playing on Saturday at Virginia. And last year's wonderful story, Appalachian State is going to go down to Baton Rouge and play LSU on opening night, and will not be a wonderful story this year by any stretch of the imagination.
We do not see a repeat performance.
No.
Just as the final NFL exhibition games were winding down, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell fully reinstated Adam Pac-Man Jones, who will now play the corner for Dallas. He's apparently befriended former Cowboys receiver Michael Irvin, so nothing could possibly go wrong there, right?
What could possibly go wrong? He's already ahead of the game, though. He did not celebrate his reinstatement by going to a strip joint.
So far,
which means
so good.
He's turned things around a little bit.
Now that the Giants will save the $8 million they would have paid Michael Strahan had he come out of retirement, you'd think the team might go a little easier on those wishing to buy season tickets for their new football stadium, which will open in 2010, but will they?
But you would be misunderstanding the National Football League if you believed that.
And America.
They're trying to push through personal seat licenses for the stadium, including $1,000 for the upper deck and $20,000 for the field level seats. This is already raising a huge stink. There's a New Jersey assemblyman who is sponsoring legislation that would ban PSLs at all sports facilities in the state. I guarantee you that thing will be lobbied into a bloody pulp by the side of the road within 6 months. But, yeah, they are not doing themselves any favors with this latest plan.
And just so that our listeners who aren't familiar with the season ticket scam understand, the $20,000 entitles you to buy a season
ticket. To buy the season ticket, exactly. That's the principle. The actual buying the ticket is the VIG, to put it in a way people in New Jersey might understand.
Much has been made of the story of Jericho Scott, a 9-year-old pitcher who's been banned from his little league because he throws the ball too hard for that particular league in New Haven. Why hasn't the time-honored practice of playing up made it to Connecticut?
More to the point, why is Jericho Scott and his family determined to go to court for his right to play down? He's demanding and now going to court to sue for the right to play in what is essentially a beginner's league. He already plays in another league where the level of play is very high. I'm not exactly sure what anybody's trying to prove except to produce a guaranteed red meat story for the brave souls on sports talk radio around the country who are already condemning this as another step towards whatever it is we're doing to our kids.
Father Antonio Rungi regretfully announced this week that he had scuttled his plan to stage an online beauty pageant in which the contestants would be nuns. Gee, what could possibly go wrong with an idea like that?
This, I keep reminding myself, is a sports program.
Contest.
Contest.
Winners, losers.
Very good. Actually, it was an online, quote-unquote, pageant. There was going to be no catwalk, no evening gown competition, no nuns playing Lady of Spain on water glasses. I mean, it wasn't going to happen this way. Father Rungi has been disciplined, and there will not be what people had called Sister Italy 2008. Such a shame.
Auto racing may not be the first sport that comes to mind when we think of environmentally responsible competition, Charlie, but do you think the Greece, G-R-E-A-S-E, to Greece, G-R-E-E-C-E, car rally that ended on Wednesday may change all that?
Hey, 8 teams using only cooking fat made it all the way 2,500 miles from London to Athens to promote the awareness of cheap and environmentally friendly biofuels. I'm telling you. If they move this down to NASCAR country and they use cooking fat for fuel, all the problems are solved.
They could go forever.
All they have to do is go around, drain the barbecues in the parking lot an hour before the race. Nobody would ever have to buy gasoline again.
Last week, Only a Game explored Michael Phelps' possible Hollywood career, and on Thursday, we learned that the Limber One will navigate the lucrative oceans of literature as well. Will he do so swimmingly?
He will do so. He can hire someone else to swim for him because he got an advance for $1.6 million. I guess the publisher must have been impressed by that small volume of short stories he published when he was younger.
The thin volume of poetry, really.
Very well thought of thin volume of poetry.
I don't know about you, but my advance...
I sing the body, glub, 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 glub.
After he was disqualified from his taekwondo match in China,
my favorite Olympian is
Cuban
back.
Martial artist Angel Matos kicked the referee right in the head. And were you surprised at Fidel Castro's take on that incident?
Viva la revolución. We stand by our man. Fidel said it was all a plot. You know, if he was an American, he could have kicked the referee in the head and he would have been suspended. I admire Fidel's loyalty, but, man, you can't be kicking the referee in the head. You just can't be doing that.
Even when kicking guys in the head is part of your sport.
I mean, you know, a synchronized swimmer can't kick a judge in the head. A taekwondo guy really can't kick a judge in the head.
And finally, at least two successful Olympians found love in Beijing, and perhaps the result will be another generation of extremely talented South Korean archers.
Yeah, Park Sung-yeon, who led the women's team to the gold medal, is going to marry Park Kyung-mo, and now it's time, I think, for our veteran music staff to go reach through the archives and pull out Sam Cooke's Cupid.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Sunday Boston Globe magazine, and he can be music editor if that ever goes south on him. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you,
and if
Charlie.
They don't do it, I'm going to kick him in the head.
If you pine for plentiful podcasts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcast. Lobster boats are a common sight off the shores of Maine. Most are built for hard work on the rugged Atlantic coast and not for speed. But as with most things powered by the mighty internal combustion engine, there is a time and a place for a race. Only a Game's Doug Trabu recently headed to Maine to hit the lobster boat racing circuit, and he has our story.
It's a bright, clear Saturday morning in Winter Harbor, a very small port in Maine, more than 3 hours north of Portland by land. At the far end of a straight track, several lobster boats, with partially open cockpits and low-slung sterns, line up with the starting boat. There's a man with a large, bright orange flag standing on the bow. When the boats pull into line, the flag drops, and the captains hit the throttle.
We're not to a friend. There he goes.
74 boats have registered to race today in the eighth of the Maine Lobster Boat Racing Association's annual nine-race schedule. I'm aboard the finish line boat, Easy Rider, near a tall buoy holding a red and white flag. Several people in race official T-shirts are preparing to record the order of each finish. There are some veterans on the crew, but it's the first time for a number of the officials, and some aren't even from Maine. At least two New Hampshire residents were recruited to join the crew during some pre-race festivities out on the town last night. Races last roughly 60 to 90 seconds. Winter Harbor's track is one of the longest and widest, so boats have the best chance of reaching their top speeds. Most boat names are painted on the transom or rear panel, so their large wakes make it hard to identify them as they pass by.
That's, who's that? Okay, that's four. What's the other one? Green.
Maine Lobster Boat Racing Association President John Johansson says the first races were held in the early 1900s off the coast of Jonesport.
As far as history, there's no real accurate records of when they started. You know, going back and starting in the 60s and coming up is basically when we started racing like we do today.
The association now has 19 classes that separate gas engines from diesel and factor in horsepower and boat length. Some boats only enter in their home port. Others travel to all the races. Each division winner gets a plaque at the end of the season, but the local ports also offer prizes. Bushels of bait, new lobster traps, cash, and all of today's racers are entered in a drawing for 1,000 gallons of fuel. Winter Harbor's prizes were valued at more than $11,000 this year. Other harbors topped $20,000. But Winter Harbor Race Committee co-chair Chris Church says something much more important is at stake.
Bragging rights, that's the biggest part of it. You know, everybody comes down, it's a real good time.
For some racers, winning bragging rights is serious business. A number of boat owners tell me about pulling an all-nighter to replace parts, tighten heads, and even trade out engines. Other owners are just here to enjoy the camaraderie. There are plenty of entrants that finish at least 30 seconds off the pace, but everyone on board is smiling all the way. The rules require just a captain and one other person to be aboard, but some boats are weighed down with at least a dozen partygoers, all in life vests, just along for the ride and the good time. One racer takes a distant second-place finish in a two-boat race in stride.
Thank you.
I almost hit it. It was close. It was close.
There are fans along the shore and on pleasure boats around the track. Rich and Sonia Sobolewski and their children came from Marlton, New Jersey, and are on board the finish line boat. Rich likes the low-key approach to the event.
There's a feel to it that's personal. It's not commercialized racing. It reminds me of drag races at home on high school nights.
And how does a family from New Jersey end up with the best seats in the harbor?
Friend of a friend.
Got connections?
Yes.
On Sunday in Pemaquid, a village in the town of Bristol, Maine, the world's fastest lobster boat, Foolish Pleasure, is on hand for a $1,000 speed challenge during the last races of the season. But there's a bit of controversy. Owner Galen Alley of Beals Island was planning to break the local mark of 59.7 miles an hour.
So all season long, everywhere I went, I wanted to break their hometown speed records. Well, I didn't know that when I got up here that I was going to have to break my own speed record, not Pemaquid's speed record, but my own. And we went 64.1 in Friendship. So it looks like we better go 64.2 if we plan on winning any money.
Unlike most of the boats, Foolish Pleasure is not a working lobster boat. Working boats often weigh several tons. Foolish Pleasure checks in at 2,300 pounds, including the engine. Alley's first run falls short at 61.1 miles an hour. Later, he wins his race, but the closest Foolish Pleasure comes to the record is 63.4. High fuel prices have hurt the industry and driven up the cost of other necessities like bait. Meanwhile, the retail price of lobster is down, and fishermen say lobster's image as a luxury item hurts sales when the economy is tight. Travis Otis is the vice president of Maine Lobster Boat Racing. He and his father, Keith, organized the races at Searsport, and they've invited me aboard First Team, a 36-foot working boat they built themselves. They're undefeated in the races they've entered this year and won the points title in Diesel Class H. Travis says at a tough time for the industry, the races are the perfect release.
When you spend 5 or 6 days a week with your head stuck in a trap, it's nice to get together with other people. We're in the same boat, really, and have a good time.
There are a number of long delays as we watch the early heats, something Keith Otis has come to expect.
Sometimes one never knows what they're waiting for. It's like watching paint peel. We're sitting here waiting for them to stage the next race, and I don't know what's happened to it.
Eventually, First Team is called to the starting line in a field of six with KE2, Taylor C., Porky's Revenge, Laura P., and Breezy Dawn. Travis Otis is at the helm and has warned me the turbo will take a few seconds to kick in. To our right, KE2 quickly pulls ahead of us by more than a boat length. Then, within seconds, Travis blasts us past the rest of the field. We cross the line with a comfortable lead at 35.7 miles an hour.
Well, that was pretty fun.
It's a long wait for a few seconds. If you see that piece of paint peel and then drop, you're there for it. But if you happen to be doing something else when it drops, then you don't know when it happened. That's lobster boat racing right there in a peanut shell. I mean, you sit around and wait and go through all the other races. You get that few seconds and you get that little bit of bragging rights. And, KE2 put on a good show.
After the race, the boats are tied together in long chains extending from the dock. People cross from boat to boat, eating, drinking, and discussing the day's biggest prize, bragging rights. Winners and losers alike all seem happy to be here. Association President John Johansson says on very rare occasions, a non-fan will ask him, why bother racing?
I tell them that the reason that we go fast is because the lobsters are going faster, so we have to build bigger boats with bigger engines.
For Only a Game, I'm Doug Trabu in Bristol, Maine.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our lobster boat racing photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from Winter Harbor Lobster Race organizer Keith Young, who explains the $5 hike in this year's race registration fee.
Well, this year it's $25 because they got a free T-shirt.
Wow, that must be a pretty nice T-shirt. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.